Yes, I'm also going to discuss a bit of what's been my experience on setting up CryoN Labs. And I think this talk is pretty important, as we've been discussing. If you are kind of at the end of your postdoc and now you are thinking on, you know, going out there, start having interviews and trying to have, you know, start your own lab in a different institution. So thank you, Clint. So, and I think I'm going to paint for you two very different scenarios, which are the two ones that I kind of been facing, you know, during my own career. I've done this twice, and it's been a very different situation. Because, you know, as a postdoc, especially if you've been lucky enough to be in a place like here in New York or in one of the big institutions that you have access to a lot of resources, maybe two or three Titan Cryoses or several Artica microscopes, and now you're moving to a different place in which maybe the resources are a bit more limited. So I think it's very important that, especially in that case, you do have a really good understanding of what are the essentials of a cryon lab in order for you to request that and make sure that you can move your research program forward as soon as you get to the new place. Okay, so the two scenarios I'm gonna paint for you is, the first one is, say that you are able to, you know, get a job in an institution with a tradition in cryo-EM, and there's an existing core facility, you know, with a lot of microscopes and so on. And the other situation is you're coming to an institution with no tradition in cryo-EM and no cryo-EM core facility. So the way you have to navigate these two systems is very different. So let me just walk you through what would be the way to go in these two different scenarios. So say you're coming to an institution that has a tradition in cryo-EM, has a nice core facility. For that, I'm just going to put the example of McGill. So we have the facility for electron microscopy research. So what is it that you then, in that situation, you need to do? And what would be the steps to kind of be successful in that environment? I think the first thing you need to figure out is basically what instruments are available in that core facility for you. And that, within that, you might have, you know, a broad range of TMs, medium range microscopes for screening. Maybe you are lucky enough to have a Titan Cryos. Maybe you also have a dual beam, something to do core site, to do correlated light electron microscopy or SEMs. And I guess, you know, because of your, you know, your projects, then you really need to have an idea what microscopes are going to be useful for your research and what others are not, you know, of your interest, right? And after that, I guess is very important as well. Okay, now I know what microscopes I have, then you need to know how to use them. And probably through your postdoc, then you became familiar with some of the systems that now you have in your facility, and that will be facilitate the process. But let's say that, you know, you've been working with GEOR microscopes, and in this core facility, they have FEI microscope, right? So so I guess in that, then the facility probably will have certain resources for you to kind of get familiar with those systems. And even if you are familiar, you're gonna have students that might not have experience on cryo-EM or in using microscope at all. So it's very important that you understand what is the training mechanism in that core facility. At McGill, we have this training program. In this training program has different modules for which the users and everybody can sign up, as it's free to every user. They can sign up as many times as they want. They run every Tuesday morning, and they kind of cycle every month. Basically, then all the modules are run, and then again, the students can access those modules and go to the training sessions and then learn how to use the different microscopes. The facility might also provide some resources on the website, so you can download maybe these protocols that are provided online. You might know how to use it because, you know, you have experience with your with you in your postdoc, but now keep in mind that in your lab you're going to have students, and you know, then somebody's going to have to train them. It's going to be you, but to having some of these protocols is
How about, do you mind just holding a microphone? Oh, good.
All right, so. I'll try my best now with this one. So keep in mind, you're going to have students now that they might not be familiar with microscopes and operating microscopes. So to have them sort of some of these resources is pretty good, because they have something to hold on to it, and kind of these programs kind of walk them through the steps on how to use the microscopes and start collecting data easily. The other thing that you need to figure out then is, okay, now there's these microscopes I want to use. How do I access those microscopes? And assuming that I now already know how to use them, so you need to kind of figure out how is the scheduling system works in that facility. So probably they're going to have something online where you can go and then book your, book the microscope that you need. Understand, and that information should be provided on the website, that there's going to be certain rules probably in that facility on how you do your booking. You don't want to kind of be the new guy, go there, book the F20 for 5 days, and then everybody's going to be upset of you because the rule is that you can only book one session at a time and things like that. So make sure that you understand those rules if the scheduler basically is not somehow limited through the software that doesn't allow you to do, you know, things that you're not supposed to do, okay? So understand the rules. It's typically in a lot of facilities for certain instruments, there's going to be certain rules of access. And in our facility at McGill, then that exists, for instance, with the Titan Krios. In there, we request to every user that the samples are basically screened, and that touched on, you know, one of the questions that I had on my list, which is, you know, how do you assess a new specimen? And in our facility, kind of the typical workflow is that, okay, we request that you take some images or do some screening of your specimen and negative staining. And if that goes well, then you're going to go to, you know, the F20 or, again, the T12 for the speed we have. You can also do the cryo-image screening. And in that case, then we ask the users to take a picture at low mark just to be able to show that they can produce grids with enough good areas with the right thickness of ice. And then we also ask for taking a few pictures of the a high mark on the holes just to see that the protein is basically behaving well, is going to the holes. And then basically then we ask the user to provide those images to a committee with a brief description of the project. And if, you know, the images are good, then the project is kind of approved, goes to the Krios, and is scheduled for, you know, the next available session, right? So so understand that, you know, then that might be that system is in place, and then you kind of have to follow, okay? Then something very important as well, in these core facilities, then this they're typically run by a number of people, so it's very important that you get to know these people as well. So they are typically really, really helpful. It's a very stressful job. If you talk to the people here at NRAM, so they kind of in high demand, they go through a lot of users every week. So it's very important that you get to know them and be nice to them, because, you know, they're trying to do their best to help your experiment. And sometimes you kind of, you're under pressure because my paper is, you know, I need to kind of send back my comments to the reviewers and my grant is due and stuff. And so it's very important that, you know, you work with them, because they're really trying to do their best to kind of help and you know, help your experiments. Okay, so that's kind of the first scenario in which, you know, you get to a place, there's a lot of resources, and you just need to learn how to use them. So that's not too different from, you know, the environment where you maybe did your postdoc. But a very different situation, and that's where I think it's very important that you have an understanding of the technique and what are the basics that you need, right? Let's say that you go to a different institution in which, you know, there's no cryo, and you are the cryo-EM guy. And because, you know, the institution now with this big wave of cryo-EM, they want to sort of really get into the train of the cryo-EM and start this, so you're going to be the person setting things, everything up, right? And that might be a difference between the States and Canada, but, you know, the way funding mechanisms work in Canada is that typically, you have to remember, you're going to be hired as an assistant professor, and even if you are coming, you know, from a very hot place, you know, you were extremely successful postdoc with, you know, 5-6 Nature Cell papers, they're hiring you as an assistant professor. And the assumption is that, okay, you have proven that you are a really extremely successful postdoc, but that doesn't mean that you can be a successful PI. It's a very different type of job, right? So typically, they're not going to probably, at least in Canada, make a $20 million investment, right up front. They are going to give you something, and then you're going to have to prove them that you are worth enough that they keep investing in the technique, right? So I think depending on what institution you're going to go and have these interviews, do your homework, and then get to try to understand what's the philosophy of that institution, and And then I guess on your request, you have to have maybe a reasonable expectation, because it's possible that, you know, is without reach for that institution. They are not willing to put the money up front in buying you an Artica for your screening and a Krios for your, you know, high resolution data collection. So I think in that case, then it's really, really important that you understand, okay, if that's not, you know, up for discussion, then what is it that I need? Or what is the minimum that I need in order to move my research program forward and still be successful and be able to do my cryo-EM? And for that, we already touched a bit on that in the previous talk. So you're going to need some. I'm not going to discuss, you know, in terms of your equipment that you need to for your biochemistry or your molecular biology, because that really depending on what area you are. And that's very, very variable. So hopefully through your postdoc, you understand, you know, how many freezers you need to have, how many PCR machines, how many purifiers. I'm just concentrating a bit on the cryo-EM aspect of your research. And obviously, you're going to need, you know, a carbon coder, very important. A good carbon coder, even though you buy your C-flats and Quantifold, you're probably going to want to modify those somehow. So it's important to have this equipment, a glow discharge that could be integrated within the carbon coder. It might be a different device, but it's important to have both. You can also going to need your Vitrobot or the equivalent plancher from a different vendor. If you don't have the money, you can just get created, build your own Jacques Dubuchet style type of plancher. They work as well, and you know, and then you can probably get one of those, you know, for not a lot of money. You're gonna need probably, and that's, you know, something important, a sort of medium range microscope to do your screening of your samples, right? So both in negative staining, and we have this T12 and the Spirit to do that, and then an F20 or some sort of similar microscope to do your cryo-EM screening. So that is pretty important you have that, and then obviously your sets of cryo holders and you know, your pumping station for your cryo holders, all those items that are pretty important and are within what we consider the basics, all right? So I think if within your startup package you are not going to have an Artica or a Krios, I think it's important that at least you're going to need eventually to have access to a high-end instrument. So how do you go about that? So I think if you are in the US or in Europe, then typically you're going to have access to some of these national cryo-EM core facilities where, you know, these different mechanisms to access time there. So it's for you important to understand what the mechanism is, because you're going to need to access those, right? In other countries, like in Canada, we don't have cryo-EM, you know, national resources for cryo-EM. So, but there's different facilities. You know, in Europe, you also have Nissan and McGill. We also take external users, you know, basically paying a fee for use, right? So if that's kind of your situation, then I think it's probably a good idea that, you know, during your interview, then you have a conversation with the chair. How are you going to access those resources? So is the, can you just have basically the university negotiating some sort of guarantee time for you and your group to basically go there and collect data? And if not, then can they provide additional startup funds that allow you to kind of pay for those fees? And that's kind of the appropriate conversation to have in that situation where, you know, within your institution, you don't have upfront, you know, by the time you arrive, you know, a super high-end microscope. But definitely you're going to need to have access to those. So how are you going to go about that aspect of your research? We already touched a bit on this. How do you service your equipment? So for microscope, service contract is a must. And I think that everyone in the room will agree with that. But as you kind of grow within this institution, you start buying more microscopes, then maybe it's things to keep in mind. Then if you have multiple instruments within the same, from the same vendor, then you're going to have a bit more leverage to basically negotiate better deals on the service contract. We can discuss maybe later, so whether your direct electron detector should be, you know, under service contract or not. I mean, they seems to be pretty robust. If you have a FEI microscope, then basically have the Falcon 3 or whatever in the same service contract might not add a lot of price. But if you have something from a different vendor, might be adding a substantial additional cost that might be not too easy to cover. I think it's important also you, as you manage your microscope, that you have strategies in place to minimize downtime, right, on the microscope. And what I found, it really helps is if you really train well your user base, right? So so there's a lot of mistakes that happen, especially if you're using a side entry CRY holder, and damages to the holders that happen because the user doesn't really know better. It's not that the person is careless. It's basically nobody trained them well. So if you have a good training program in place and you show them how to use the stuff, the equipment properly, then that tends to minimize the the errors, and the mistakes, and some of them are pretty costly. So so I think, if you are in charge of basically the facility, or I guess you have a say on that, then I would really try to emphasize that there should be a really good training program in place, because long term that really helps on optimizing the workflows and minimize the downtime of the instruments. Things to keep in mind if you have the money to do that. So there's a few items that if they break, then basically the whole workflow kind of stop. And that could be, a typical example here is the CRY holder. So if you can afford to have two, it's a really good idea, because if one of them break, because one of the students has a problem with it or something, then you can just send that one for fixing. But then you have the other one that you can keep using, because probably it's going to take maybe 2, 3, or 4 weeks or a bit longer sometimes to get your CRY holder fixed. So maybe it's a good idea to consider to have two of them. Validate equipment. We already discussed this, so I'm not going to put a lot of emphasis on this. Different facilities do it different ways. So the microscope, in our case, the medium range get aligned every week, and then those alignments get saved, so the students can recall the alignments. So for the high-end instruments, that we also do, acquire information limit images just to before the session, or frequently, just to ensure to the user that is collecting the data that the microscope is, performing well. You also want to do some evaluation of the DQE, maybe twice a year, and also this is a good idea, just to put a test specimen. You just run the whole pipeline and then see if you are getting to, the typical benchmark resolution that your instrument should be reaching, and then you do that, with certain frequency, just to make sure that the microscope is performing. And then now what is, I think is also important is now we have it through Legion or Scipion box, that's the one that we have at McGill, to kind of monitor the data collection as it's happening. So the movies kind of get a stream out of the microscope, and then that gets into this GPU box that immediately do the movie alignment, STF estimation, and then sort of output some sort of graphs that monitors the data collection that is happening. So that allows you to really basically see if the alignments start degrading, or you start having a huge amount of drift or something, then allows you to kind of immediately see that, pause the instrument, and then correct whatever corrections you need to do, and then just relaunch the data collection. So at the end, then you ensure that you maximize the data that you are collecting that is high quality, and you are not collecting for 2 days blindly, and then you realize later that after day one, then all my data is really really bad. Okay, so I think with that, then thank you for your attention, and I guess happy to entertain some discussion about these topics.
Joaquin, when you said that your staff align the microscope weekly, is that a base alignments weekly, or is that just direct alignments?
So what is done every week is basically the direct alignments. So so they just go and then spend about an hour with each one of the F20 and each one of the T12 and the Spirit. And that gets basically saved, and then the students, I mean, we actually ask the user not to do any alignments on the microscope. If you want to learn alignment, because you have an interest, then we actually ask them to book a one-to-one training session with one of the operators so that they can learn that. But what it gets done routine every week is the direct alignments, and that gets saved, yeah.
Well, can you set, sorry.
I can't have a question.
It's a question regarding when you're hiring a facility manager, what kind of job description are you describing for the facility manager? Like, what is he or she supposed to do? And if something happens during off hour, like say at night and stuff.
Yeah, our facility manager basically is a person that can do everything. It's because it's a person that is basically so it has to have interpersonal skills. So it has to be, is the person that is basically the where every new user goes and basically, so has to be good on communicating with people, good on organizing things, coordinating things, has to be able to multitask a lot because, you know, a facility where you have like 10, 12 different microscopes is a lot going on every day. Something always go wrong, one microscope, something. So then technical skills are also good. So Kelly Sears at McGill, so he's a PhD level manager. I mean, he has, you know, a lot of years of experience with many different microscopes. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess also you have to see, you know, how much you can pay for that person, right? So obviously if the amount of budget you have for that is limited, then the number of skills you can request in that person is, yeah. But I would say, you know, if you can have access to a PhD level person is desirable with, you know, that all those skills.
Joaquin, you said that a new investigator should have reasonable expectations about what institutions buy for them, but I think a lot of new investigators are facing the inverse problem, mm-hmm. where they go to a new place and they're expected to set up three Krioses, Antarctica, and I wonder if there's some words of wisdom that some can be passed on from either people's experiences or senior investigators who might want to pass on wisdom, like Bridget.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a different problem, but it's also a very difficult situation because, I mean, if you're coming out of your postdoc, you might have again certain experiences doing your research, but management is a very different one, right? And manage a facility with three cryos or even one cryos is you know is not easy. It's a lot going on every day. So yeah, make sure that I would say in that case, make sure that. Obviously, you're going to hopefully, within the courses, they give you some possibilities to hire staff. Make sure you get surrounded with the right people, with the right skills, because I think that's what it will really you know, make sure that you are successful. And maybe Bob can comment on that too.
Well, I have another aspect of it. What happens when a user can't be trained? How do you break it to how do you break it to their PI that, you know, maybe they should have another person in the lab being the one that's trying to do this stuff?
Yeah, that's a great
experience.
That's a great point, Bob, because it's always a difficult conversation, but I think you need to have that conversation with the user. And because at the end, yeah, if they break a crowd holder, then you are looking at, you know, $6,000 fix or something like that, and there's that many number of, you know, invoices you can pay. So I think it's important that you have that conversation. And then if a student for some reason doesn't have, you know, good skills to or even, you know, ability to learn that, then it has to be always done with somebody from a staff member that kind of coach the student on the tricky parts of the. Of the product, I would say the crowd transfer, you know, for instance, right?
Bob, so one thing one can do that now with a facility manager, we have assisted usage and independent usage, and so you can have someone that is never allowed to move to the next stage. So the microscope is always going to be operated by someone else for that person. It's more expensive for the PI, and the PI might understand what's going on, but that way everybody and they can keep moving forward, and you're sure that nothing is broken.
Yeah, because I think you need to balance that. Like, you know, if they break the microscope, then everybody goes down, right? So it's something they need to understand.
Just a comment on that. I think in one way to do it would be to have, if they break something, to make them pay for it. You know, make the PI pay for it. And I mean that'll be motivation to... Then maybe you don't have to talk to him.
That's what I do. If I have the conversation, no, I still insist my student does the, you know, use the microscope by itself. Okay, then if it breaks, then you're going to be the one paying, right? So